Welcome to the program for Friday, January 6, 2012, on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. 3 o'clock on Friday, as always, the Federal News Countdown. And today is kind of a historic day on the Federal News Countdown. The first week in January of 2010 was the first time I ever did the Federal News Countdown. And one of the people who was on that show is here today to celebrate, I guess this would be the second anniversary and the beginning of the third year of the Federal News Countdown. It's Alan Baludis of Cisco. It's great to see you, my friend. Happy New Year. Happy to have you on the show today.
Congratulations on your success with this.
Well, I don't know if I'd call it success. Nobody's told me to stop yet is how I look at it. So I'm just going
to
continue.
I just want to say, too, you look lovely today in your Senator Santorum sweater vest.
Thank you very much.
It's very flattering.
Thank you. I was going to send around a memo that it was going to be Sweater Vest Friday. The person in the office who actually conducts that normally is Justin Udo. And today's his last day on the program. He's going on to a bigger and better adventure, and we wish him well. But we'll have to establish that as a custom whenever you come on the show.
Well, in any case, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me back.
I'm happy to do it. I'm happy to have you, and I appreciate you putting out a good word about the program to your colleague who was on the program with me yesterday on Industry Chatter. Dan Kent was on the show.
Oh, great guy.
And enjoyed him very much, and you can hear that on federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Also here for the second anniversary show of the Federal News Countdown is my friend Tim McManus of the Partnership for Public Service. Great to see you as always.
Always great to be here, too.
And Happy New Year to you. You didn't bring Samantha along today.
No, I'm going solo.
Flying solo. You have a very able assistant who does your outreach and media and so on, Samantha, and she comes with you folks a lot. Not here today. We miss her. But we have a terrific Federal News Countdown, and we will dig in, of course, with
number three.
The third most important federal news story of the week is chosen by Alan Baludis, is from Information Week, and the headline is FBI's beleaguered Sentinel project delayed again. And this sounds like it's fallen victim to the waterfall mentality, Alan, that Vivek Kundra and now Stephen Van Roekel are trying to eliminate.
Well, that and of course, this has been on the troubled list for some period of time. As I think you know, this is a project that dates back 15, 17 years. Mm-hmm. It was the automated case file that's used by agents and analysts to manage documents and other information related to their case. And I think first big award on this contract came in 2006. So this is one of, it was tough for me because this is also the week that the Coast Guard killed the Deepwater Project, mm-hmm. which is a $27 billion project spent to date. Of course, this is one of the reasons CIOs were created all those years ago to deal with these so-called runaway systems, the mm-hmm. ones that are over budget, behind schedule, and not delivering the promised functionality. And in this case, Sentinel or whatever automated case file alias is kind of one of the poster children for these kinds of runaway systems.
Now, you have a unique perspective because you've managed the financial side and the IT side of these kinds of projects in government. Do you get any sense that agile development is or will soon help some of these projects turn the corner? The reason I ask that is because this Information Week story says, 2006, the FBI awarded Lockheed Martin a $305 million contract to lead development of Sentinel, took back control of the project September 2010 amid delays and cost overruns. At the time, the FBI said it would finish Sentinel within 12 months using agile development. So just the idea of agile development in and of itself, in this case, wasn't enough to do the trick.
Yeah, well, of course, we have to get a little bit deeper in terms of, you know, whether they're just using the right terminology or they're using the right methodology. Mm-hmm. But I think the efforts that Vivek started in terms of how the government ought to approach and manage these implementations, and Van Roekel has continued, are clearly the right way to go. But I think some of these projects, if they start off in government, I have the feel that you have a short period of time to get something right. And after that period of time, the kind of bad habits calcify And you're really not going to fix it. You almost have to break it and start all over. And I think in this case, Deepwater is probably the better example of this. I think the Coast Guard has declared Deepwater dead, rest in peace, and it is going down a new track with a recapitalization effort to do much of the same thing. Because the need for the system doesn't go away.
Right. We have details on the Deepwater situation on federalnewsradio.com. We also have Alan Baloudis' number three story of the week on the Federal News Countdown, which is headlined, FBI's Beleaguered Sentinel Project Delayed Again. It's from Information Week. Tim McManus, your story number three in the countdown is headlined, New Performance System Could Lead to General Schedule Overhaul. It's from the Federal Times. And as I read this, I thought, well, they've been working at this since pretty much like as long as the general schedule has existed. What makes you think that we might actually get some progress done with changing the general schedule system this time?
I think one of the unique things about this pilot program that's being launched, and there's five agencies that are actually looking at a new performance management system: VA, HUD, Energy, Labor, and Coast Guard. And I think what gives me great optimism or great hope is that agencies are actually trying this out, testing out to see how it works and if they can effectively make this happen. I think the second piece of it is this performance management system goes beyond a simple form. The checklist, you know, on a scale of 1 to 5, how has Alan actually performed his job?
I would say one.
One being great.
Oh, yes, then 5.
But I think really what the essence of GEAR is what they're calling this system. It stands for goals, engagement, accountability, and results. I think the essence behind this is much more than a form, but it really calls on agencies to create a culture of ongoing conversation. Mm-hmm. What this really is great performance management at its best, which is frequent conversation with an employee about his or her performance. Are they achieving the goals that are set out? Have they not? If not, how do we get you back on track? It's not about, yes, there's quarterly sessions built into this, but it's not about, okay, the number of times you sit down. It's about creating this culture of performance.
The what I have noticed that when it comes to performance management in particular over the last couple of months is that just about every time I talk to anybody from a union, whether it's about this issue or not, they try to work in at some point during the conversation, we're not standing in the way of getting rid of poor performers. It's almost like they've all gotten together and said, let's make sure we're getting that message out there. I had Bill Dugan from NFFE on the other day, and it was talking about labor management partnerships, and that specific issue didn't come up, but we talked about the fact that labor management partnerships are designed to make sure that the employees have a role in how things are managed at the agency and that they understand what's going on sufficiently that they can stay engaged and continue to perform at a high level. But if not, out the door they go. And so I think it's interesting that this story mentions that a working group from the National Council on Federal Labor Management Relations is involved here to at least make sure they're involved. I mean, that's where NSPS, it seems, went awry on a performance management issue, was the unions just said this, we don't have any input on this at all.
That's right. And again, I think that's reason for optimism about why this will be much more successful is those conversations are in fact taking place. And again, I think certainly the unions themselves are most concerned that any type of performance management system is actually implemented fairly. I mean, that's the number one concern, I think, that whether or not it's SID or not, that's the concern that they've got. And again, if you're able to take this beyond simply the process of and really begin to build and change a culture so that it is actually focused on performance, I don't think there's anybody that can really argue with that.
Yeah, it's interesting parallels in these stories we've selected because in both cases, I think we're talking about initiatives that have a long history of failed attempts. And perhaps it shows the difficulty of bringing about some of these basic fundamental changes in when we're talking about how the government does business. But I think we both remain optimistic that some of the new approaches will work.
Tim McManus is story number three in the countdowns from the Federal Times. The headline is New Performance System Could Lead to General Schedule Overhaul. And you can read it and all of the stories we're counting down today on the Federal News Countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The second most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Alan Baludis and by Tim McManus, when the Federal News Countdown continues on In-Depth with Francis Rose.
Mission goals through technology, brought to you by General Dynamics Information Technology.
It's the end of an era at the U.S. Treasury Department. As of January 1st, paper savings bonds are no more. The agency's taking another step away from paper and into electronic transactions as new savings bonds transition exclusively into an electronic system. Treasury estimates the move away from paper will save it around $120 million per year. From now on, the way to get electronic savings bonds is through the agency's e-commerce website at treasurydirect.gov.
General Dynamics Information Technology is dedicated to providing the latest, highest quality information technology services and resources to help organizations meet their mission objectives. Large-scale IT systems and communications networks are the strategic and operational heart of defense, intelligence, civilian government, and private business. They require the expertise of a company that delivers results. General Dynamics Information Technology and professional services. Go to GDIT.com to learn more. That's GDIT.com.
The men and women of our National Guard and Reserve Forces are working hard on the battlefield and here at home. Employer support of the Guard and Reserve is working just as hard for them. For over 36 years, ESGR has paved the way for greater understanding between our Guard and Reserve Forces and their civilian employers, promoting a culture where all American employers support and honor the military service of their employees. Together, we all serve. To learn more, visit www.esgr.mil.
Hi, this is Wayne Zell, host of Blueprint for Wealth, every Saturday here on Federal News Radio at 10 a.m. Please join me this week for my special guest, Paul Pagnotto of the Pagnotto Carp Group of Hightower Advisors. Blueprint for Wealth is brought to you by Odin Feldman and Pittleman, a full-service law firm located in Fairfax, Virginia, serving the entire D.C. metro area. If you'd like to get in touch with us, visit us on the web at www.ofplaw.com.
We simultaneously celebrate as the clock strikes midnight on New Year's. Now bacteria are being engineered to do something similar. Potential applications range from environmental sensors to medical therapies. Engineers are building genetic clocks in bacteria inspired by cell machinery that creates our circadian rhythm.
We rely on the same kind of design principles that nature has adopted via evolution.
Jeff Hasty, a University of California bioengineer, is using bacteria with fluorescent proteins and setting genetic timers that trigger them to glow on and off at certain intervals. Then, through fast-moving gases,
each cell communicates the phase of its clock to other cells, which caused the cells to beat synchronously.
Hasty says enough cells would create a visible sensor that could
change the period of the clock in response to some pathogen that's in the environment.
The concept might also lead to fine-tuning of medical applications like gene therapy. With the National Academy of Engineering, Randy Atkins, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Tom Temin here with a preview of Monday's Federal Drive. The intelligence community's been reauthorized for 2012. We'll talk with the Intelligence and National Security Alliance about what's new. Plus, DOD has figured out a way to allow smartphones and tablets to connect to its enterprise networks. First, it's Android, but iPhone is not far behind. Those stories and more Monday morning starting at 6 on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. And for all the latest federal news, be sure to visit federalnewsradio.com.
Back on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Every week on the Federal News Countdown, two people who are experts in the world of the federal government choose the news stories they think are most important to people who work for the federal government from the week just ended. And my experts today are Alan Baludis of Cisco and Tim McManus of the Partnership for Public Service. And we're up to
number two.
Alan Baluta's choice for the second most important federal news story of the week is from GovExec, from NextGov. The headline, Air Force to offer second round of buyouts. And I don't know that anybody's really surprised that this is happening. The Air Force has said we're getting down to FY 2010 staffing levels. But this just reinforces to me that we're probably not done with these by any means, right?
Yes, I picked this story to some extent because it's emblematic, I think, of so many other things that are swirling around us these days. One, of course, we were talking about briefly during the break, and that is the press conference the other day with the president and Secretary Panetta talking about some of the serious cuts the Department of Defense faces, not only the ones that they've carved out themselves, but those that they will face under the sequester because of the failure of the supercommittee to reach an agreement on the deficit. So reductions, it looks like, in not only the size of the Air Force, but the size of the Army, the size of the Marine Corps, cutbacks in major weapons systems. I think similar kind of reductions being faced on the civilian side of the government as well, because one of the things that's been striking to me is that while the Democrats and Republicans can't appear to agree on very much, you know, the Republicans propose cuts in Medicare and Medicaid, the Democrats are totally opposed, the Democrats propose tax increases, Republicans are opposed. The administration proposes cuts in DOD, and both parties are opposed. But what they all seem to agree on is the government workforce is too big, it's overpaid, has too many benefits, and that government workforce includes not only federal career employees who actually work for the government, but the substantial workforce that some have estimated is six or seven times the number of people who actually work directly for the government in that kind of contract workforce. They're in that same category. So they all seem to agree on that. So I think this is the first sign of what a difficult and challenging year it's going to be for government employees, both direct employees and the contract workforce, in terms of attacks on the size of the workforce, the benefit package, everything.
And Tim, this is right in your wheelhouse because
I set Tim up perfectly.
You did. Magnificent. And the reason why you're a repeat guest on the show, I haven't figured out why I keep inviting you back.
I haven't figured that out either. But
no offense, Tim. But no, seriously, though, this is right in the area that you work with agencies on every day, which is keeping people who are working for the government engaged despite the kinds of things going on that Alan's talking about.
Yeah, and again, you know, it's as you're looking at buyouts, you hope that those that maybe are less than stellar performers are the ones that are actually taking advantage of that to some extent as well.
You're hoping
that what's not happening is that your very best talent is saying, yeah, we're the ones that actually want to take advantage of that and seek another opportunity. I think, you know, it's also a great tie into my next story, and I don't want to jump the gun here too, but you know, part of this question when you're offering buyouts is are the right people actually taking them, and if the right people. The right people, however you define that as being, but then also to what extent are some of those folks replaced, and are they replaced with the right people replacing those that you're offering buyouts as well? So you could actually get into a situation where the wrong people are actually taking the buyouts, and therefore you're stuck with a workforce that's less than desirable and actually, quite frankly, can't help meet your mission central needs. And that's actually, you know, always a concern when you're talking about both trying to hang on to people as well as trying to bring people in the door.
Well, how do you think the agencies are doing at evaluating who the right people are that should be taking these buyouts to then offer them to?
Well, I think by and large, agencies are getting better at doing that. I think, you know, in part, I think they are, they're somewhat forced to do that based on their own programmatic budgets as well. So, I'm hoping certainly with the Air Forces that are looking at this, they actually are tying that back to mission and looking at really where their priorities are and then what the staffing levels are and what the skill levels are of those staff that are actually going to have to help them meet that mission. Those are the folks clearly that they shouldn't be offering buyouts to.
Key question will be is, who will drive this? Will it be driven by some of those HR and program managers who are looking at the future needs, or will it be driven by the budget and finance side, which in the Air Force case is we got to come down by 6,000 and, by God, we're going to get to that number. To hell with the longer-term consequences. Mm-hmm. So I think the big issue will be in this coming year, to what extent will the fiscal constraints and the budget pressures and those kinds of things be the drivers of this, and how will it deal when it runs full up, as Tim has suggested, against management needs and program goals.
Alan Baludis' story number two on the Federal News Countdown is from NextGov. The headline, Air Force to offer second round of buyouts. And you can read it and all of our stories on the Countdown today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Tim McManus's number two story of the week on the Federal News Countdown is next. This is In-Depth with Francis Rose.
Frank Shalufo, Associate Vice President and Director, Homeland Security Policy Institute at the George Washington University, commented during the panel discussion entitled Cyber Power, Which Nations Will Emerge as the Cyber Powers of the 21st Century? Brought to you by Booz Allen Hamilton.
There's a big difference between cyber terrorism and terrorist use of cyberspace, which is primarily intended to enhance and facilitate their tradecraft, whether it's for communications purposes, whether it's to fundraise, whether it's to do targeting analysis.
To hear the entire show, go to federalnewsradio.com, keyword Booz Allen.
Booz Allen Hamilton believes that cybersecurity is no longer just about protecting assets, but about enabling organizations to take full advantage of the vast opportunities that the ecosystem of cyberspace now offers for business, government, and virtually every aspect of our society. Count on Booz Allen to help you be ready for what's next. Learn more at boozallen.com/expertvoices.
The Washington Capitals are bringing the excitement of hockey to local classrooms with Caps at School. Caps at School is a free online curriculum-enhancing teaching tool for grades 1 through 6 that uses the sport of hockey to teach science, math, language, art, health, and physical education. Teachers and students participating in Caps at School can also win visits from Capitals players and Slapshot teachers. For more information on how to enroll your class for free, visit capsatschool.com.
Please join the American Federation of Government Employees for its series Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. The weekly program gives you the real story on what's happening inside federal agencies and the rights of federal employees. Hear the latest from the nation's top lawmakers, celebrities, journalists, union leaders, and federal workers. Don't miss AFGE's Inside Government, Friday at 10 a.m. right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m.
There are those who dedicate themselves to a sense of honor, to a life of courage, and a commitment to something greater than themselves. They have always defended this nation and each other. They still do. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Smokers in Training. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Ira Dreyfuss with HHS HealthBeat. One thing some students seem to learn in college is how to smoke. This learning can lead to personal biology lessons later in life from a cancer doctor or a heart surgeon, but a study indicates that in college, many are not constant smokers yet. At the University of Missouri, researcher Nicole Cronk looked at smoking patterns reported by 207 fraternity and sorority members. She says they smoked more at party time.
Smoking tended to be more frequent on the weekends, so Fridays and Saturdays, and then drop off on Sundays and steadily build up again to the weekend point.
She says students can help each other by having smoke-free parties. The study in the journal Substance Abuse and Misuse was supported by the National Institutes of Health. Learn more at hhs.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Ira Dreyfuss.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy?
For freedom.
Freedom of religion.
What America stands for.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy? For honor.
Everybody. And watch out for everybody.
Freedom to vote.
Democracy.
Freedom to go outside and play with my kids.
I joined the Navy to serve my country.
Every freedom that we have.
The right to raise our kids in peace.
My little brother.
My wife.
My kids.
Our children's children.
The United States Navy.
It's not for ourselves alone that we serve.
This is In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Every week on the Federal News Countdown, two people who are experts in the world of the federal government choose the news stories they think are most important to people who work for the government that took place in the week that has just ended. My experts this week choosing the three most important federal news stories of the week are Tim McManus of the Partnership for Public Service and Alan Baludis of Cisco. And Tim McManus, your story number two is Emily Kopp's FederalNewsRadio.com story that is headlined, "Will 2012 be the year agencies focus on succession planning?" And we were talking with Alan during the break about the idea that it better be, because it ties in with Alan's number two story, Air Force losing some people. And those people have information, knowledge in their brains about how the mission's accomplished. And every agency is the same way. These people go away, and it's not always easy to capture that information when somebody goes out the door.
Yeah, and what to complicate things a little bit is, you know, we've been talking about this retirement tsunami for a long time now. Mm-hmm. And what we've actually begun to see is January is typically the time frame to start seeing, you know, people heading out of government. What we've actually seen prior to January even is that there's been an uptick in number of retirements. So whether or not there's a huge – whether or not the big wave's coming yet or not, I don't know. But, you know, we're at least seeing some ripple effects. And I think this becomes even more important given issues of buyouts, given issues of – not being able to hire at the levels that we've been in the past. You really have to think
only being able to replace two out of every three, mm-hmm. three out of every four.
So who is that person you replace? What does that job look like? It's interesting that we had a great conversation during the break. At some point, maybe, you know, think about
doing an open mic
break or something here. But, you know, oftentimes I think what we, not only in government, but in all sectors, look, when somebody leaves our organization, we tend to say, so Alan's left, let's take out Alan's job description and let's repost that because we need to replace Alan. And that's actually not the way that we should be thinking and need to be thinking. We really need to think about what it is that we need in order to achieve our mission, what it is that we're going forward.
Right.
And I think that the key part of that conversation that we had during the break is, part of the paralysis, I think, with so many organizations, both in and out of government, is the issue of responsibility. Whose responsibility is it to think about this? And oftentimes, we tend to just hit the default button and say, this is an HR issue. This is the Chico's issue to drive. If we as leaders and managers are doing our job correctly, that's actually where this has to lie. Mm-hmm. We're the only ones that can look forward and say, this is the state of play. This is what our field is going to look like 5 years from now. This is what the talent needs to look like. This is what our mission has to look like going forward. We're the ones that have to be on the front lines making those calls and saying, this is the type of skill set. These are the competencies. This is the type of individual that we need. And probably here's the size of our workforce in order to get that accomplished.
Mm-hmm.
If that's actually not coming first and foremost from leadership and from what we'd call those line managers or hiring managers, then I think we've actually got this entire equation backward.
Mm-hmm. How do you turn that equation around, do you think, Alan?
I think it comes from emphasizing how important the workforce is for you to be able to achieve your mission, and it's going to become even more important as probably that workforce gets smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And we've already seen it happen at the state and local government levels. In fact, a lot of the deadening effect in the economy and in the employment arena comes from some of the cutbacks that have been happening in the state and local government arena. But I'm actually one of those people that looks at some of this, if in fact this tsunami finally occurs, as there's an opportunity in this as well to bring in a new generation of people who are not only more comfortable with and facile with the information technology that's current today, but also in terms of their work style, approach things in a more collaborative and open manner.
Mm-hmm.
So while we do a lot of hand-wringing about the fact that this generation may be leaving, I think there's, you know, it's that notion of the way the Chinese write crisis, you know, there's an element of opportunity in this as well, and we ought to be focused on that. And that just reemphasizes Tim's point about the greater importance of succession planning as opposed to the old, like, oh, let's just repost the 27-year-old vacancy announcement we used when we first brought so-and-so on board now that they're going out the door.
Yeah. You mentioned the retirement tsunami, Tim. You're right. We've been talking about this since it seems like the Mesozoic era.
The wave broke somewhere out in the ocean.
Yeah, it did. Is this going to materialize, or is this going to continue to be a white whale that nobody can find?
Well, you know what? It may, in fact, be a white whale that nobody's able to find. But the bottom line is, you know, the federal workforce is aging, and the federal workforce to begin with is actually older than what it would be outside of government.
Mm-hmm.
So whether it's a tsunami or it's a wave or what, you know, term it what you will, there are going to be people who are leaving. And I think regardless of whether it comes all in one big shot, which is, I think, clearly what has been anticipated for a long period of time, that we were going to just see kind of the cliff.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that cliff happens or not, succession planning, and particularly as it relates to this, it has to happen regardless of whether or not it comes overnight or not. And I think Alan's point about, you know, this being an opportunity, we need to look at all of this actually as an opportunity. And there is great opportunity if we think this through. And the concern that I have particularly around succession planning and the environment that we're now in and probably entering into even more wholly going forward is that this matters even more now. Whether you hire one for every two or one for every three or whatever the case might be, we got to, one, make that hire right, but two, we got to make sure that we're hanging on to the right people as well and making sure that the transfer of knowledge is accurate.
Next hour, you and I are going to talk about that very subject, making sure when you bring somebody in that you're getting the right person the first time. So that's about 45 minutes from now on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Actually, Alan is very upset because you're actually going to be on the show twice today. In addition to being on this hour, you're going to be on that, and he's only on for this 1 hour. So he's just...
I've already ravaged the studio here.
I did manage to get the sledgehammer away from him. So anyway, that's Tim McManus's story number two of the week on the Federal News Countdown. It's Emily Kopp's story. Will 2012 be the year agencies focus on succession planning? And it, like all of the stories on this week's Countdown, are linked up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we continue on the Federal News Countdown, the most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Tim McManus and by Alan Baludis, it's Federal News Radio 1500 AM. We'll be right back.
This is NIH Health Matters. I'm Joe Belinfi. During January, experts are stressing the importance of dilated eye exams to protect against glaucoma. Dr. James Tsai at the Yale School of Medicine says glaucoma is a group of diseases that damage the eye's optic nerve.
Damage to the optic nerve can initially cause blind spots at the outer edges of the field of vision.
If not caught early enough, glaucoma can cause total blindness.
The eye care professional has to do a dilated exam and carefully look at the optic nerve for signs of glaucoma, as well as assess the side vision or visual field.
For more on glaucoma, visit www.nei.nih.gov. Health Matters is produced by the NIH, part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
America's top show about planning for retirement is on 1500 AM WFED. Sunday mornings at 8, it's the Financial Safari
Each week, America's income planner, Coach Pete DeRuta, sits down with father-daughter duo from Northern Virginia, retirement planners Don and Jill O'Rourke from O'Rourke Asset Management. Sunday mornings at 8, it's the Financial Safari on 1500 AM WFEV. Newsmakers on In Depth with Francis Rose.
Congressman Joe Walsh, he's chairman of the House Small Business Subcommittee on Economic Growth Tax and Capital Access.
The federal government spends about $40 billion a year on software purchases. And typically through overpurchasing and underpurchasing, they waste about 30% of that number. So there are just some simple little things like this that can become big things in actual savings.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/in-depth.
The Department of Defense faces some big changes in the coming years. I'm Federal News Radio's DoD reporter, Jared Serbu. We help you track those changes every Wednesday afternoon from 2 to 3 with On DoD. Each week, we'll talk one-on-one with defense experts and senior managers about the policies, programs, and innovations that affect warfighters and how the military will continue to meet its mission. That's On DoD, Wednesday afternoons at 2, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
This is Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. You're listening to In Depth with Francis Rose. This week, the most important federal news stories of the week are chosen on the Federal News Countdown by Alan Balutis of Cisco and Tim McManus of the Partnership for Public Service, and we're up to
number one.
The most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Tim McManus, is from NextGov. The headline is OPM must create a federal intern database, and must is no kidding here. This is President Obama signing legislation requiring this. Why is this a good thing or a bad thing? Why is this something we should care about, Tim?
So first, I chose this as the number one story because actually there's the story is not in fact all 100% accurate.
Oh.
That
never happens.
There's been an effort by Congressman Connolly and Bill Bray to introduce legislation to help improve federal internship programs. And language was included in the National Defense Authorization Act that President Obama recently signed. The NDAA actually does include a couple of things that are good first steps in terms of helping agencies better coordinate and helping job seekers figure out where to go for internships. And those two things that NDAA includes is actually it requires federal agencies to designate a point person and contact information for their internship programs. And then secondly, it requires OPM to provide links to internship programs on a central database or a central website.
Mm-hmm.
But that's actually not the database that this story refers to. One of the things that was not included in NDAA that was in fact in the separate legislation was for OPM to create a database of all federal agencies across government with their strengths and weaknesses so that if Alan were trying to hire somebody but didn't actually have an intern that could be converted to full-time employment either at his agency or at his disposal, he could go into the central database and say, wow, I want Francis Rose. He actually meets every qualification, and I can bring him in non-competitively. That's the way for me to go.
That would be a terrible database that said that I had every qualification for anything.
It's a far-fetched example.
Well, yeah.
I know.
But not included in NDAA. So ultimately, NDAA itself only includes those two things that I talked about.
Uh-huh.
The report language actually encourages OPM to look at the feasibility of doing that, as well as also encouraging federal agencies to use a best practice, which is around surveying and exit interviewing their interns so that they can get expectations. So, you know, is there something significant to this? I think the significant, Francis, is this, that Congress actually cares somewhat about federal internships, and they should, because internships ultimately ought to drive that entry-level pipeline into federal government.
Mm-hmm.
That's the good news here. I think there's still a lot more that needs to be done here. And, you know, the pathways programs that have been proposed and are hopefully soon to come out through final regulations will, again, put an added emphasis on this. But this stops way short of where it needs to be.
But it's a shame it required a law to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and Tim mentioned this, in passing earlier, we say again and again, you know, we really need to recruit the best of the brightest. We need to draw young people into government. We need to refresh the work pool. We need to create these vehicles. And then we in having spent 29 years in government.
The
myself,
royal we.
With a royal we manage these things so poorly, and we really don't do what needs to be done to really attract, and once we've attracted, kind of keep and retain those people within, we squander a lot of the resources that could be used to replenish that cadre of mid and senior executives. And clearly, government needs that infusion of new blood and new talent.
Now, I normally don't read the comments on blog posts or stories or whatever, because I just find I get sucked into this time-wasting vortex and I can't get that time back. But there's one comment on this story that I wanted to see what you think of. Somebody posted to this story, and we have this linked up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The cure is actually easy. Agencies shouldn't be able to hire additional interns for a particular series or skill set if they have graduated interns in the data bank. They must hire their graduated interns first. That will prevent offices from serially abusing the program. Does that make any sense at all to you?
Well, I think I think it makes sense if you're viewing that in terms of what so often was what I would say would be a misinterpretation of interns. And I think that's actually the bright spot of the Pathways programs that are coming down the road, is it calls internships what internships are. Mm-hmm. And internships in the new era are only for students, so you have to currently be enrolled. So counter to this, if I have to hire a full-time employee, I'd go to that database if it made sense. But to bring on an intern, somebody in that database more than likely wouldn't qualify because they've already graduated and they're actually looking for full-time employment. People in full-time employment are not interns. Interns are students who are in school. And I think that's actually where a major disconnect has been in government for so long, is we've talked about internship programs being developmental programs. Call them developmental programs if that's what they are, but they're not internship programs.
Yeah, but this is – we got to kind of lift the curtain here on the seamy underbelly. I mean, the proliferation of internship programs that existed that drove a lot of the pathway initiatives to kind of get this under control was that agencies were creating these programs to get outside the normal hiring process in government, because the process is so difficult and takes so long that they wanted to set up their own mechanisms to be able to reach out to young talent, bring them in on board in a quicker process, and then try, once they were in and they had tried them out in some fashion, to bring them on permanently. So that led to the proliferation of this, and it's because the basic process is so broken and flawed that, you know, Tim is – I don't mean to put Tim on the spot on this.
I was going to say, you're hammering him pretty hard.
I'm reaching out to him for validation of this.
No, I think that's absolutely right. So for instance, I think what to me what that comment actually strikes to specifically is the Federal Career Intern Program. Mm-hmm. And I would argue that the Federal Career Intern Program was really not an intern program. And it was not an intern program either for agencies, nor did students see it because what it was an entry level hiring mechanism. Right. That's the way that it was designed. It wasn't mm-hmm. it was an entry level hiring mechanism to provide developmental opportunities and help grow somebody into the position. That's a lot different than an internship program, both from the agency perspective, but more importantly, this is where the disconnect has been for so long with government, is they haven't actually viewed this from the eyes of the student. Mm-hmm. If you talk to any student on any college campus and you say, we're going to bring you in as an intern after you've graduated, they're going to look at you like you've got five heads.
This is surprising to me, though, because I'm not familiar with government ever naming something incorrectly and having it cause confusion.
It's probably a flaw in the acronym brand. You know,
the Department of Acronyms. Tim McManus' story number one on the Federal News Countdown is headlined, OPM Must Create a Federal Intern Database. And you can read it and all of our countdown stories at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Alan Baludis' number one most important federal news story of the week, when the Federal News Countdown wraps up in minutes from now on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
We raise high for GW basketball. Some raise high with the jump out of your seat, buzzer beating, hands to the sky scream. Others give their all in the GW fight song, Raising High the Buff and Blue. Raising High is more than just a movement. It's the movement for Colonials basketball, where senders and students, friends and families come together for the thrill of victory. Raise High with GW basketball today. Call 202-994-7325 or visit gwsports.com now.
Moving your enterprise to the cloud doesn't mean you have to let go of IT control. With BMC's proven cloud lifecycle management from IronBow, you can visualize and manage data and applications in public, private, or hybrid clouds through a single pane of glass. It gives you the control you need to deliver peak performance for users. Find out more about BMC Cloud Lifecycle Management and the BMC Public Sector Forum at ironbow.com. Keep your IT in view and under control in the cloud.
Concerned about your health? Then be sure to catch the groundbreaking radio show Essentials of Healthy Living, brought to you by Village Green Apothecary in Bethesda. Join hosts Dana Lake and Kevin Passero as they bring you the latest news about traditional and alternative medicine, dietary supplements, nutrition, and healthy living. Tune in every Sunday at 10 a.m. on Federal News Radio. Visit myvillagegreen.com. Listen to past shows and discover other healthy living resources. Essentials of Healthy Living is sponsored by Garden of Life and Boron.
Welcome to today's lottery drawing. And today's winning numbers are not yours, not yours, and another number that's not yours. And the final number is not yours.
When it comes to having money, don't rely on luck. Brew your own coffee at home instead of buying that latte. Brown bag it to work instead of ordering in. Go to feedthepig.org for more free ideas on how to save.
Feedthepig.org.
This message brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
This is In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by Tim McManus of the Partnership for Public Service and Alan Baloudis of Cisco. And Alan Baloudis' number one story is the Washington Business Journal story headlined Obama and Panetta Note Defense Department Cuts But Offer Few Specifics. And I will say, of all the stories that I've seen on this, Alan, I think that this story, the headline on this story, crystallizes the whole situation the best, because I don't know if you had a chance to listen to the actual event, but the Q&A section, when the reporters were asking questions of Secretary Panetta and General Dempsey, if Secretary Panetta said once, well, all of the details on that will be in the budget when it comes out next month, once, he had to say it at least 10 times, it seemed to me anyway.
Yeah, I thought Jill Arturo did an interesting job in this story. Now, a few more details have filtered out over the last day or so, but still not many. And I think this is interesting, too, because it clearly Secretary Panetta, who's one of the kind of consummate and most skilled Washington insiders, has clearly already signaled himself with his language that these cuts are draconian, the cuts that would occur under the sequester of the Deficit Reduction Act are a doomsday device, that anything beyond this initial round of cut would really endanger national defense. You have a couple of the major Republican candidates for the White House who have already indicated they're very opposed to these kind of reductions. So we're going to go through, I think, a year of real theater as we talk about these reductions, and are we going to hollow out the military again, as was alleged we did right after World War II, before Korea, and right before Vietnam, and right before some of the other things. So it's clear the political kind of intricacies and aspects of this are going to be high drama in the months to come.
Tim, if there's anything that we've learned, though, in the last 6 months especially, but I would say 18 months to 2 years, it's that Congress can figure out a way to either snatch victory from the jaws of defeat or snatch defeat from the jaws of victory, whatever they choose to do at a particular moment. And so whenever somebody says sequestration at any particular time, my response is, if it happens, because we have a whole year for Congress and a presidential election to go through for Congress to be able to figure out a way around it.
Yeah, I think if it happens, how it happens, all of those questions come back into play. I think, whenever we hear that there's going to be significant reductions, people tend to shudder. And I think rightfully so, because too often, I think what we've seen in government is that when there are reductions, there hasn't been necessarily rhyme or reason to those reductions. And I think, Alan, you alluded to that a little bit in your opening piece there, which is, let's take the axe or the chainsaw at it to cut stuff. But are we cutting in the right places? And what's the long term, not simply the short term effect of this, but what's also the long term effect?
But I wrote a column about this recently, where I actually suggested that, in fact, we shouldn't be disappointed with what's happened to date in terms of deficit reductions, because we're actually perfectly positioned. We have what can aptly be described as a do-nothing Congress. Its legislative record is actually worse than the do-nothing Congress that President Truman ran against in 1948. But now we have a situation where come January of next year, all these automatic sequesters will go into place on top of the deficit that reduction cutbacks already agreed to. All the Bush-era tax cuts will come to an end. A series of other cuts in Medicare and Medicaid that have been agreed to earlier will take place. The reductions will be twice what was agreed to or was proposed for the super committee, and all we have to do is do what government seems to do best these days, nothing, for this to happen.
If we're relying on government, especially Congress, doing nothing to be successful, then I think we're in terrific shape, Alan. I think you're right about that.